Jesus sat to teach, the rabbis sit to teach, the imams in the mosques sit to teach, why shouldn't I? But I'm going to begin with an apology. Do any of you remember this from last year? Some of you actually signed it. And I've been showing it to people for the last 12 months. But I got this on false claim. I had said last year, I'm in my 80th year. I didn't say I was 80. You're only 80 when you've completed your 80th year. And so last year you gave me this for my 80th birthday, and I was 79. So I kept it at home for my 80th birthday and brought it out then. And now I'm showing it to people because now I'm eligible. Actually, many years ago, I asked the Lord if I could preach for him till I was 80. And this year, he answered that prayer. Now, my subject is, who is entitled to Jerusalem? In June of 1967, I was in a bus in Jerusalem, bumping over some very rough ground. I was in the first bus to cross from West Jerusalem to East Jerusalem for 20 years. And the ground was rough because it was a former minefield, and they had only just dug up the mines from that field. In fact, a dear friend of mine, the Baptist pastor in Jerusalem, had rescued a little girl who ran into the minefield in Jerusalem, and he ran after her and saved her, but a mine blew up and took his leg off, and Bob had a wooden leg for the rest of his life. That was because Jerusalem was a divided city, and this great strip of land sown with landmines kept the two parts apart for 2 decades. And we were on the first bus to go across. We were in a hotel in West Jerusalem. We were on our way to Jericho, and we were bumping over this old minefield. Fortunately, all the mines had gone. Now, that was early morning. We came back at night the same way, but we didn't recognize the place. There was now a tarmac road with pavements either side and with lampposts, all done during the time we'd been down by the Dead Sea. The whole city was reunited in hours with new streets, new lamps. You couldn't see where the no man's land had been. If any of you here went to Jerusalem during those 2 decades, you would have had to cross by hand or on foot and carry your luggage in your hand through what was called the Mandelbaum Gate. And there was a narrow path through the minefield for visitors to Israel to get from Israel to Jordan. 20 years previously, the new baby state of Israel was attacked by 3 Arab nations, Syria in the north, Jordan in the middle, and Egypt in the south. And Jordan won the battle for Jerusalem and took over the whole of Old Jerusalem. And from then on, Jerusalem was under siege. And trucks tried to get through up the only road to Jerusalem with supplies of food and even water. And they were fired on from both sides by Arabs. And the city might have been lost altogether. But the Jews managed to save West Jerusalem, but they lost the old city. and one quarter of the old city was Jewish, had a number of synagogues in it, and it also contained what was then called the Wailing Wall, which was the only part of the Jerusalem temple still standing. It wasn't even the temple. It was part of the platform that Solomon built over the hill of Moriah to make the top bigger. And in fact, the surface at the top was about 13 acres on which 13 cathedrals could have been built. And Solomon built just the one big temple on the top there. But Jesus said the temple would be pulled down stone by stone. And it was. And all that remained was the platform with the western or Wailing Wall on the western side. And that was in the Jewish quarter. And the only bit of the temple that the Jews had to go and pray. And they used to squeeze through narrow streets in the Jewish quarter and go and push bits of paper into the western wall with prayers on. But when Jordan took Jerusalem, they took Jewish quarter as well. They destroyed the synagogues. They razed the whole thing to rubble. They went onto the Mount of Olives and they despoiled Jewish tombs, built a great road through the middle of the Jewish cemetery. And Jerusalem, as far as the Jews were concerned, was no more. But in June of 1967, the three nations, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, attacked again. I know that Israel began it. I know that they had a preemptive strike that destroyed the air forces of those nations before they could even get off the ground. And the Six-Day War, as it was called, was a triumph for Israel, a unique event. But they had said to Jordan, Jordan, please don't join in the fight. Leave it to Syria and leave it to Egypt. But Jordan, with an army trained by the British Glub Pasha, was sure they could win. And so they joined with Egypt and Syria to attack. But this time, Jordan lost. And the whole of Jerusalem was taken by the Jews, by the Israelis. And I can remember going to the Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall it was still called, to see thousands of Jews, again after 20 years, able to go and touch the stones of the old temple. Soldiers in their uniform, all weeping. And the stones of the wall were dripping with tears. I'll never forget that. They now call it the Western Wall. They don't wail there now. They've transferred that name to the Income Tax Office. And they go and wail there now. But they celebrate at the Western Wall. And so I was there for the celebrations of the reunion of Jerusalem, the coming together at last of one city after 20 years of a divided city by that dreadful minefield. But now people are talking of dividing it all over again. They want to make Jerusalem into two capital cities. Even though it's not all that big. The world believes now that the solution to the problems of the Middle East is what they call the two-state solution, in which Jerusalem will become two separate political capitals. East Jerusalem, the capital of Palestine, and West Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. That is the world opinion now, to divide the city again. Mind you, the Jews, the Israelis, have had to put up a wall sectioning off certain Arab suburbs because of the dreadful business of suicide bombers coming in and slaughtering innocent men, women and children with bombs. They had to put up that wall, and it has reduced the number of suicide bombers by 90%. Imagine if missiles were coming from Belfast to Liverpool in increasing numbers. Imagine 3,000 missiles from Belfast into Liverpool. And if the British government did nothing to protect Liverpool, what do you think the people of Liverpool would think? Well, the Israeli government had to try and stop those bombers. I hate the sight of the wall that divides off some of the Arab suburbs and separates some Arabs from their families and even from their property, their vineyards or their olive trees. Nevertheless, it was a necessity to protect the citizens of Israel. But now the talk is of dividing the whole city right through the middle again, roughly on the lines of the division when the United Nations superintended the Jordanians and the Israelis and kept them apart. And that could come again. So I've been asked to talk to you about who is entitled to the city of Jerusalem. Who can claim it? To whom should it belong? This is the big issue now before the United Nations. And it's one that we will all be involved in and certainly interested in the days to come. It is, after all, amazing that Jerusalem should be the center of world attention. It's not a big town. It has spread recently, but until recently it was a tiny town up in the hills, hidden from view by a circle of mountains. And it's not an important or significant place. It's not strategic. It's not on a main river. It's not on a main road. It's just up in them there hills. So why is the world so interested in Jerusalem? Why has it become such a key issue for the United Nations? It is quite extraordinary, really, as if a little town up in the Pennines was suddenly the world's biggest issue. And when you look at how many times Jerusalem is named in the press and on the television and in the media generally, it is an amazing fact. Why should it? Well, one of the main reasons is, of course, that the world's energy comes from the Middle East. Oil is the basis of our economy in the Western world. And it's essential that there be peace in that region for the world's supply of energy. That's one reason why the world is so interested. Peace in the Middle East is essential to our economy, to the Western economy. And therefore there must be peace there. And the biggest problem to peace is in the Promised Land between the Palestinians and Israelis. And Jerusalem is the focus of that issue. Do you know that 4 times the Israelis have offered to give the Palestinians the occupied territories? Up to 94% of them. And 4 times they have refused that offer. Why? Because the real issue is not the occupied territories, but Jerusalem. That is the real issue. And years ago I said, if the Israelis gave all the land that they want to the Palestinians, they would still not be happy until they get Jerusalem. And behind the local conflict between Palestinian and Israeli is a much bigger conflict. It is essentially a religious conflict, though the politicians will not acknowledge that. It's the struggle between Allah and Yahweh. It's the struggle between Islam and Judaism. And they are now at daggers drawn. And this is a threat to the whole region of the Middle East, and therefore a threat to the world's oil supplies. I hope you have heard the news that for the first time oil has been discovered for Israel. Have you heard that? It is a remarkable piece of news. In what's called the Levant Basin in the sea, just off Haifa, they have discovered millions of barrels of oil and a huge amount of natural gas. You know, it was Golda Meir who said, why did Moses lead us all the way through the promised land to a land that had no oil? Now they've got it. They will be exporting oil in the future. That is going to change the situation dramatically. Nevertheless, the world is still anxious to see peace in the Middle East, because the whole region is being affected by the conflict around Jerusalem. Well, now, who is entitled to the city? There are many people today who are treating this question as a human question, and they're tackling it at a human level only. And so for the first half of the talk I'm giving, I want to look at those human questions and the human claims that are being made. And that is what the politicians are listening to, and that is what they talk about. I don't know of a single leading politician in the Western world who is talking about any divine claim to that area and that city. So what are the human claims? There are three arguments that are being used. The first is this: the historical claim. Now that claim divides into three simple questions. Who had it first? Who had it most? And who had it last? And the argument centers around these three issues. The appeal, first appeal, is to the past. Who had it first? Well, the answer is nobody knows. Jerusalem was occupied 2,500 BC. By people whose remains have been found, and I've seen their remains, their bones. Nobody knows who they were, where they came from, or whether they left any descendants at all. By the time we open our Bibles, we find Jerusalem was occupied by the Jebusites. One thing is quite clear: there are no Jebusites around today. No trace of them has been left. So when we say who had it first, there are no Jebusites to back up that claim. Recorded history after the Jebusites is that David took the fortified town from them and made it his capital. And it remained the capital for the next 1,000 years of the Israelites. Which brings us to the second question: who had it most, meaning who had it for the longest period? And people are arguing about this. The answer is the Jews had it for 1,000 years, 500 of which it was politically free. It was their own capital. From then on, it was the occupied city of people like the Egyptians, the Seleucids, the Greeks, the Romans, though it was still the Jewish capital, the center of their religious life, the center of their government, the Sanhedrin. So 500 years it was their independent capital, and another 500, it was their occupied capital. But they were finally turned out of it in the year AD 135 by the Romans, who were fed up with Jewish terrorism. And as you probably know, they destroyed the Jewish temple, took it down stone by stone, as Jesus had predicted. They plowed up the center of the Temple Mount. They renamed Jerusalem Aeolia Capitolina, gave it a Latin name, and they named the whole land of Israel Palestina, or Palestinia, from which we get the name Palestine. It didn't come from the Philistines. It came from the Roman name for that region. Then we know that the Roman occupation lasted until Constantine, the emperor, became a Christian. I agree with the previous speaker, that was a very mixed blessing, to say the least. I would even call it a curse. But he made Christianity the established religion, and his mother Helena, who was a devout Christian, went to the Holy Land and replaced the pagan temples, which had been built by the Romans on the sites of the Jewish temple. She replaced that with Christian temples tied to the sites of Jesus Christ. That's when the Holy Sepulchre Church was built. And many other churches were built at that time, primarily to be places for Christians to come and pray where Jesus had been. By the way, the Israeli guides call me the man who runs where Jesus walked, because when I take people there, I take them around the place as quickly as I can to see as much as possible. But everywhere we go, people say, why did they put a church here? Why did they build a church on this site, on the Mount of Beatitudes? Why a church? Which, by the way, was built by Mussolini, dictator of Italy. But why churches everywhere? The answer is so that Christians could go on pilgrimage and pray. That was the thinking. And pilgrimage then became part of Christian devotion, which it certainly hadn't ever been before. And it was considered a good thing for Christians to go to the Holy Land and pray in these churches on the sites where Jesus had done something. Constantine made a dramatic move by shifting the capital of the Roman Empire from Rome to a place called Byzantium, on that little strip of water joining the Mediterranean to the Black Sea, a port. And he renamed it Constantinople. And so the whole empire shifted east. And from that city came a whole new missionary outreach to spread Byzantine Christianity. And so for the next few hundred years, the Byzantines owned Jerusalem. And that's when you have Byzantine architecture appearing, especially church architecture. It was a so-called Christian empire, not the Roman, but the Byzantine, in the east. Then came the Muslims, and Jerusalem was overrun. And for the next 600 years, Jerusalem was a Muslim city, and that is having a profound effect on the claims to the city today. The first mosque was the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the south end of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, before the Dome of the Rock was built. Now, we'll look at the Muslim claims to Jerusalem in a moment when we look at the religious aspect of the arguments. I'm just looking at the historical. So the Muslims had it for 600 years at first, and then under the Ottoman Turks, they had it another few hundred years. Total, 700 or so. Now bear in mind, the Jews had it for 1,000, 500 independently. The Muslims have had it 700. So they become the main two bodies who claim Jerusalem on a historical basis. You with me? There was a brief period in the 11th century under Muslim control when the Catholic Church called for the liberation of the pilgrimage sites in Palestine from the Muslims, and the Crusades, with the terrible history of that. The Crusades are still thrown at Christians in the Middle East, as if they happened yesterday. And the Muslims don't distinguish between Catholics and Protestants. They blame us all for the Crusades. And that also comes into the historical argument. As you know, that was only for, 150 years? And then Salah ad-Din defeated the Christian armies, and there was a retreat, and Jerusalem and the Holy Land became solidly Muslim. Right up to the Ottoman Turks. And then in 1917, General Allenby, the British general, a fine Christian, Bible student, led the British army into Jerusalem through a gap in the wall at the Jaffa Gate, which had been made for the German Kaiser's visit. And he wanted to ride into Jerusalem with his attendants on horseback, so they pulled down the wall of Jerusalem at that point for him to ride in. General Allenby came in the same way, but he walked with a bare head, being a Christian, and took Jerusalem without a shot being fired. There was a rumor that his name was Allah Bey, which frightened all the residents, and he came in without firing a shot. Then it became British. After World War II, we British were put in charge of the Holy Land. I'm almost up to date historically, but can you see that many different people have occupied Jerusalem? Many, many, probably 17 nations have conquered it one time or another. So the historical argument is a really mixed argument. And as I've indicated, it's left to the Jews and the Muslims to argue that out. So who had it first? The Jebusites. Who had it most? The Israelites. Who had it last? The British. Before them, the Turks. And then in 1948, Israel was declared as a nation. And within months, Jerusalem belonged to the Arabs. It was part of Jordan. I remember being in old Jerusalem when a riot broke out and bullets and stones were everywhere on the Temple Mount. And our guide, an Arab, fled for his life. And we fled north to our hotel, which was near St. Paul's Cathedral and near the YMCA building on the north side. And that was just one of the troubles during the 20 years when Jordan controlled the city. I wish I had time to tell you one of the miracles that happened, but the King Hussein introduced a curfew and forbade us to go anywhere in the city. And here I was with the church group stuck in a hotel. And the senior officers of the Jordanian army were billeted in the same hotel. And while we sat in the lounge singing choruses, And we had an opera singer with us singing the gospel. The senior officers of the Jordanian army were in the bar next door. And their leader said, "Would your opera man come and sing for us? We've nothing to do." And we said, "He'd love to come and sing for you, but he only sings Christian songs." They said, "We don't care what songs are, come and sing." And so we spent 2 hours singing gospel songs to the Jordanian army. And so impressed were they that the general wrote on a piece of paper and said, "Here, take this. You can go anywhere in Jerusalem while the curfew's on." And for the first and only time, we had the whole city to ourselves. Nobody on the streets but us. And there's more to that story, but I haven't time to tell it. You can read my autobiography for that. Well, there it was. So, should it be Turkish? You know now that Israel and Turkey have fallen out. That's serious. Did you know that Israel gets her water from Turkey? Israel is desperately short of Turkey, and there are tankers bring fresh water from Turkey to Israel. They could lose one of their major sources of water over this latest trouble. But Turkey could claim we were the last to hold the Holy Land. Jordan could claim it, I suppose. You can't say who had it last. You've heard of Lawrence of Arabia. I was looking at his effigy in the city of Wareham in St. Martin's Church the other day. And he led to the promises made to the Arabs that they could have the Middle East. At the same time, Lord Balfour, a Christian man, the Foreign Secretary of Britain, were promising that the Jews could have a homeland in the same area. And those contradictory promises have led to so much of the trouble since. But Lord Balfour didn't promise Jerusalem to the Jews. He promised a homeland for the Jews. So the historical claim, past, present or future, really is so mixed up that it won't stand on its own. The most that could be said is that the Jews had it longer than anyone else. So we turn from the historical arguments to the political arguments. And these arguments are in the media almost daily. The arguments center on two political subjects: justice and peace. And these are the two concerns of politicians. And they belong together, because you cannot have justice without peace, without justice. Where people sense injustice, that they are treated unfairly, you will never have peace. You will have violence. And at the root of the present conflict in the Middle East, over Jerusalem itself, is tied up with these two issues of justice and peace. Let's look at them separately. First of all, the issue of justice. Who are the people who are most crying out that we have been treated unjustly? The answer is the Palestinian refugees. But let's look at some facts. Fact number one, 500,000 Palestinians fled what is now called Israel in 1948 during the War of Independence. Partly they were afraid of the Jews, and the Jews didn't always behave correctly. There was one sad massacre by the Jews in a little village called, what is the name? Some of you will help me here. Deir Yassin, and that is still the icon of Palestinian unrest. 500,000 Palestinians lost their home and land, But they had been told by Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, leave the land because we're going to wipe the Jews out, and then you can go back to your own homes and lands. Well, of course, they couldn't. A friend of mine in a little village called Kufa Yusif in northern Galilee, that means village of Joseph, and it's named after Josephus, the Roman historian. He lived there. And I met a lovely little Arab man, lovely Christian, with four grown-up sons, all of whom are evangelists. And this little Arab, in 1948, went to the Arab bank in Haifa and took all his money out and put it in a Jewish bank. And his neighbor said, "You're crazy! You're going to lose all your money." "No," he said, "I believe the Bible." He said, "It's you who'll lose your money." And they all did. And he saved his money because he banked it on the Bible. And his sons are now evangelizing in the Arab world. I just mention this because we don't hear these things, do we? Well, now, they feel a sense of injustice. But I want to give you another fact. 850,000 Jews had to flee from Arab countries at the same time. You'll hear about the Palestinian refugees. Why? Because they were kept in camps as a political pawn. They were not given homes or land in the huge Arab territories around Israel. They were kept in filthy camps, miserable camps, I've been in them, as a political pawn, and to this day, they are used to justify what's called the right to return. And that is raised in every peace discussion about the present situation. And the Palestinians will never be content until there's a right to return. Nothing is said about the Jewish right to return to their homes and lands where they lost everything. Why do we never hear about the Jewish refugees? Because little Israel, with so very few resources, took them all in and gave them a job and a home and land, didn't put them into refugee camps. I just throw that in because so often we only hear part of the story. So the cry for justice from the Palestinians, it needs to be matched and considered carefully. What about justice for the Jews? But the world is now taking the side of the Palestinian very clearly, and Israel is increasingly criticized for its injustice. What about the other political issue of peace? I've told you already, the Middle East is like a cauldron. It's boiling the whole time. It's a place of profound unrest. There have been so many conferences, so many proposals, so many peace plans, so many roadmaps. None of them come to any success. You see, the big problem is Israel's security. The cry for justice, hand back the occupied territory and the occupied West Bank to the Palestinians, would leave Israel, everybody in Israel, within reach of the missiles that have been pouring in from Gaza. Israel territory is only 9 miles wide at the middle, and every home in Israel would be within reach of the present missiles that the Palestinians have. And really, to ask Israel to release all the occupied West Bank would be to commit suicide. There would be no security for Israel if they did that. So these political arguments are complex, and they are not clear. They don't give a clear answer to who has the claim to Jerusalem. It is purely an expedient answer to say, let it be divided into two capitals. But that is what the United Nations want to do now. So we turn to the religious claim. Just to add something to the political claim, Palestinians have never been a nation. They have never had Jerusalem. But that is what they're claiming, for political reasons, not historical. But let's now turn to the religious claims. We all know that Jerusalem is the focus of three world religions: Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, all called monotheistic, believing in only one God each. And all have some claim to Jerusalem. The Jews, I've already mentioned, that claim is historical as well as religious. This is their most sacred place. This is the holy city. This is the very center of their faith. That is their religious claim. Well, let's consider second the Christian claim. Now, Christians today are not so passionate to claim Israel as a Christian city. They were in the Crusades when the Catholic Christians claimed it, but not now. I don't know of any Christian who says Jerusalem should be a Christian city. It belongs to us. What does belong to Christians are many churches, hospitals, schools in that city. And they are now defending their rights to their property in the city, but not to the whole city. Any damage to Christian property in the city would raise problems. But as long as Christian pilgrims are allowed freely to enter the city, and as long as Christian denominations are allowed to have their buildings and centers there, and most do, then there's no strong claim on the part of Christians to take over the whole city. It's a different matter when we consider Islam. The Muslim claim to Jerusalem is that it is their third holiest city on earth, after Medina, where Muhammad began his work, and Mecca, which he later conquered. But Jerusalem by name never appears in the Quran. You've heard that it's 800 times in the Bible, but not once in the Quran. So how do they claim that it's theirs? Very simply, one night Muhammad had a dream. I think it was a dream while he was asleep. It would have been a vision if he'd been awake. And he dreamt that he rode a white horse into heaven and rode it back again on the same night. It's the Muslim equivalent of the ascension. But Muhammad dreamed that it happened in a distant place. He didn't name it, but he said, I went to heaven from a distant place. And it was very soon afterwards that that distant place was identified as Jerusalem, and in particularly the El-Aqsa Mosque. And so Muslims revere the Temple Mount because this is where Muhammad ascended to heaven. And that has become a major claim. You may be interested to know that in the earliest days of Islam, Muslims prayed towards Jerusalem. They picked that up from the Jews. But after conquering Mecca, the whole thing switched, and from then on, they prayed toward Mecca. So it's the third holiest city. And they claim the Temple Mount in particular as the sacred place for Muslims. Now that has created a major problem. It means that any threat to the Temple Mount starts trouble. Intifadas start in trouble over the Temple Mount. When the Israelis excavated further along the western wall, that started an intifada. Do you remember it? That tunnel went nowhere into the Temple Mount. But the Israelis were accused of digging under the Dome of the Rock so they could plant bombs there. And the whole first intifada blew up. The second came when Ariel Sharon dared to visit the Temple Mount. And again, the whole situation blew up. The Temple Mount is so sacred to the Muslim that trouble starts there. It is the hottest spot in Jerusalem. They don't mind the Jews praying to the Wailing Wall. That's not the Temple Mount. But anything on top. Now, Orthodox Jews will never visit the Temple Mount because they don't know where the Holy of Holies was. And therefore, they dare not go up there in case they tread on the Holy of Holies. I think I can tell you where it was. Some excellent excavation work was done by a man called, an Israeli called Kaufman, and I believe he has identified where the Holy of Holies is. In fact, I'll describe it for you. If you go up onto the Temple Mount with your back to Al-Aqsa and you're climbing steps to the Dome of the Rock, a wave over on your left-hand side beyond the dome, you will see a little circle of columns, about eight of them, with a little dome on top. That marks the Holy of Holies by everything the Bible tells us. So if you go there, go and look at that. That's where the Holy of Holies, and it's dead in line with the Golden Gate and with the Mount of Olives. Any of you seen it? You have. You know where I'm talking about. So that's the religious argument about Jerusalem, and frankly it settles down to between two groups, Judaism and Islam. Christians are not trying to get the Holy Jerusalem. They don't make a claim. Well, now all that is purely human. I've not mentioned the Bible, I've mentioned it, but I haven't quoted from it. But that's the kind of level of the arguments that are going on at the moment. Arguments which totally ignore God. And therefore arguments which are purely human and are living at this level. And that's where all the discussions take place that are in the news. But now I want to turn to the divine factor, which to me turns the whole thing upside down or right way up. The two books that have biggest influence in our world today are the Bible and the Quran. The biggest influence. They cannot be harmonized. There are too many contradictions between them. Therefore, we have a choice. The Quran or the Bible. Some people are trying to convince us that you can melt both into one. Rubbish. I even dare say blasphemy. Allah is not the God of the Bible. But I was hauled up to London to answer for that statement by 40 evangelical missionary societies. And they were all angry with me because they said Allah is the God of the Bible. And these are evangelical missionary societies. And I was invited to meet their representatives and then really told off for undermining what they call their apologetic method, which is to say to Muslims, we've come to tell you about Allah. To me, Allah is not the God of the Bible. For one thing, he's only one person all on his own. Very lonely God. our God is three persons in love with each other. That's a total difference. They can never be reconciled. Tony Blair, after leaving 10 Downing Street, said, "I am dedicating the rest of my life to uniting the religions of the world." And he started what he called the Faith Foundation to do it. It will get nowhere, I'll tell you that now. But there is a move today to unite the monotheistic religions. Get them together. They will not mix. They never will. With too many contradictions. From even little ones like, did Abraham nearly sacrifice Ishmael or Isaac? Quran says it was Ishmael. Bible says it was Isaac. You can't have both. But there are big differences, the biggest of which is that we have found that God is three persons in love with each other. And Allah is a man all by, a person all by himself, in love with no one, apparently. Because the two words you'll never hear used of Allah are Allah is love and Allah is Father. So let's turn to the Bible. I believe the Bible, for a number of reasons. One is that it's full of historical and geographic facts which can be checked and have been. And archaeology is a friend of the Bible. My second reason is that it's a more balanced view of God than any other holy book in the world. It balances his immanence and his transcendence. It balances his justice and his mercy. It's the most balanced theology you will ever read. All other theologies are unbalanced in one direction or another. And thirdly, my Bible makes most sense of the world in which I live and the state it's in, and of me and the state I'm in. It makes most sense. So for those three reasons, I have read the Quran, but I still choose the Bible. Now, what does the Bible say? Well, we've heard that Jerusalem is mentioned 800 times, and that means the New as well as the Old Testament. Who is entitled? To entitle. When I'm asked the question, who is entitled to Jerusalem, I answer, who is entitled to entitle? Do you understand the question? Who has the authority and the power to give it to anyone? Well, the answer today is the United Nations or the International Court of Justice in The Hague. They are looking to some international body to decide who shall have Jerusalem. But I know someone who has both the authority and the power to entitle anyone to it. He's the one who made it and the whole earth. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And God is alone entitled to give it to anyone he chooses. It is his choice because it's his property. And of course that what follows immediately is the fact that he has given the title deeds to the Jewish people forever. He is entitled to entitle, and he has entitled the Jewish people, the descendants of Abraham, to the whole land, which includes Jerusalem in the middle of it. And he has done that permanently. He not only has the authority to do that, but he has the power to give any property to anyone. This is both Old and New Testament teaching. Deuteronomy or Acts 17, Deuteronomy 32 or Acts 17 both say the same thing. Paul on Mars Hill in Athens said, God decides how much time and space every nation has on earth. Do you believe that? Then you must believe that God took away the British Empire, and that God gave it. Do you know 21 civilizations have come and gone, and it's God who decides, because he has the power as well as the authority. I believe God has the casting vote in every election. That is why I was able to go and tell Margaret Thatcher, God has chosen you to be Prime Minister of England. Well, of Britain. I want to be the first in the country to congratulate you. And you know, she referred to that in her first press conference at 10 Downing Street. Because I had asked the Lord, I'd been out in Israel weeks before, and my wife had gone back to England, and her last words were, did you get a postal vote for the election? I said, no, I'm afraid I didn't. She said, well, you can't vote. I said, no, but I can pray. And I was in the hotel by myself praying, and I said, Lord, who are you going to vote for in the 1979 election? And he said, as clearly as that, Margaret Thatcher. And I thought, what can I do about that? Pulled a sheet of hotel notepaper out of the drawer, and, dear Mrs. Thatcher, God has chosen you to be Prime Minister of Britain, and he wants two things from you. And then I didn't dare send it. I thought, you know, she doesn't know who I am, she'll think I'm a crazy. And I went walking in Tel Aviv down the Dizengoff High Street, and I was praying, Lord, shall I send this letter? And I looked into a Jewish bookshop window, and there was a framed text in the window. For Jerusalem's sake, I will not keep silent. For Zion's sake, I will not hold my peace. And I remember saluting. I said, all right, Lord, I'll send it. And some friends from Jerusalem came to pick me up the next day. I said, please, we've got to go to the post office first before we go to your home. I said, why? I said, I've got an urgent letter. And I pushed it through and said to the girl behind, put as many stamps as you like on that, but it must go express. And she put loads of shekels on the envelope. And my friends saw who it was addressed to and said, what are you writing to Mrs. Thatcher for? I said, well, just to tell her she's going to be Prime Minister. And they said, well, you will be in our home for the election. And if she's not elected, we throw you out of our home. I said, why? Would you vote for her? What is it? Are you conservative? They said, no, we don't entertain false prophets. Well, she was elected. And 2 weeks later, I was flying back to England, and they changed my ticket from British Airways to El Al. And I said, you can't do that. I'm leading a group of people back to Britain. I'm in charge of them. I'm responsible to get them home. They said, no, that's the ticket you've got to fly on. So I got onto a jumbo jet with a little Jew called Menachem Begin. I said, where are you going? And he said, London. Said, I'm going to try and meet Mrs. Thatcher. Now, one of the things I had written and told Mrs. Thatcher was to make friends with Menachem Begin. So I told him, it's all fixed up. I've written to her. Now, lest you think that God is Tory, I was in Australia some months later, and I saw a photograph of a trade union leader on a newsstand, and the Lord said, that's the future Prime Minister of Australia. He was very left wing. And I began to announce in the churches, pray for this man, he's going to be your Prime Minister. They said, pray for that boozing womanizer. I said, he's going to be your Prime Minister, and you'll have to pray for him then. And sure enough, he was. Can't think of his name for the moment. Great big chap. Anyway. I'm getting off the point. Pull me back. So God gave the land and Jerusalem to the Jews. And every empire that has overrun Jerusalem over the years has vanished from history. Isn't that amazing? Assyria has gone. Babylon has gone. Rome has gone. Greece has gone. And the British Empire has gone. Do you know that when Britain took her hand, washed her hands of it, Palestine in 1947, and said we want nothing more to do with this place and this people, within 5 years, the British Empire, which had covered the world, had been reduced to a few places like Gibraltar and the Falklands. I believe God said to us, if you can't look after my people, you can't look after any. So all these empires have come and conquered Jerusalem and gone and vanished, and Israel is still there. How can you explain that? Twice they've lost their land. They've been without their own language, their own army, their own coinage, their own flag. For centuries. And there they're back in the middle of the world, and the focus of the world's attention. Explain that if you can. Now let me say that many Christians see no future for Jerusalem. You mentioned this, and I'm afraid it is the sad fact. The majority of churches in Britain see no future in Israel or Jerusalem. If anything, they are swinging to the Palestinian cause. But I have more to say about that tomorrow afternoon, some very important things. But the majority of Christians in this country are replacement in their thinking. Church has replaced Israel. Christians have replaced Jews, and therefore they do not see any reason for Christians to support Jerusalem or Israel. Now, what is true, and I don't think I'm contradicting you here, David, but I believe that God has abandoned Jerusalem, and that he did it on the day Jesus died, and that when the veil of the temple was split from top to bottom, 40 feet high and split by God, not man, it was dark inside. The glory had gone. The Shekinah had gone. That was the symbol, the visible sign of God's presence in the tabernacle. And then when they built the temple, the Shekinah came in and dwelt. That was the symbol of God dwelling in Jerusalem. And he had chosen Jerusalem as his spiritual home on earth. I find it fascinating that Jews are so afraid to say the word God, they won't even write it. They just write it capital G-D. They are so afraid of using the word God that they often use another synonym for him. They often use heaven. They wouldn't talk about the kingdom of heaven, but the kingdom of God, but the kingdom of heaven. And they often say, heaven help you. And that's become a saying in English, but not a reverent one. But often when they want to refer to God, they say the name. The name will help you. Pray to the name. And the Bible says God set his name on Jerusalem. And the Hebrew word for name is made up of just two letters. One looks like a W and the other looks like a D. And if you look at the topography of Jerusalem, you'll see the W in the valleys of Jerusalem. the Kidron Valley, the Tyrrhenian, and the Valley of Hinnom, which join at the bottom. You ever notice that? The W is there, and the D is the shape of the hills around Jerusalem. God has set his name, even in the geography. That's just a little bit of interest for you. But the Shekinah has gone. And they built these new churches and mosques to try and be glorious. They've covered the dome. I remember the aluminium dome being covered, or whatever it was, being covered with gold. King Hussein paid for that. And it's shining in the sun, but it's not glory. It's man-made substitute for glory. The Shekinah is not there. And therefore, the replacement boys say, God has left Jerusalem. Why should we bother about it? Well, there's a very simple answer, and I must begin to conclude. I'm a bit like Paul when he says, lastly, he lusts. Well, there's a simple answer, and it's this. The glory is coming back. The Shekinah will appear again in the face of our Lord Jesus Christ. For he always reflected the glory of the Lord. The Bible talks about the future of Jerusalem. And the future is very clear. God has future plans for his people. And they will persist to the very end of history, as long as the sun shines and the sea waves roll. Israel will be a nation before God. No other nation has such a future. The gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. There are many, many predictions of Jesus' return, but there's no doubt where he's coming back to. He's not coming back to Washington or Moscow. He's not coming back to Rome or Canterbury. He's coming back to Jerusalem. And that's where you'll meet him. On your first free flight to the Holy Land. We're meeting him above the Mount of Olives. And the glory is coming back. And this means that Jerusalem will belong to a Jew. He will reign not just over the 12 tribes of Israel, but over every nation on earth. And every tongue will confess and every knee bow. And Jerusalem will be the very center of God's glory on earth. So, where is Jesus coming back to? We know the answer. When is he coming back? We don't know the answer. But we have been told to watch for signs. And I'm watching for those. Of the four major signs he gave us to look for, one and a half are clearly here. Two and a half are not yet. Now that I'm 80, I'm beginning to doubt if I'll see the other two and a half. I don't mind that. If I die before he comes, I get a front seat at the big meeting. Because the dead in Christ rise first. So I'll be there before those of you who are still here. So I don't care which it is. I'd love to still be here when he comes, because then no one will measure me up for a box. I'll have my new body. Which means I'll be 33 again. I can't wait to get a 33-year-old body like his glorious body. That's another point. So Jerusalem will finish up in the hands of a Jew. I love to go around the world telling people, did you know you have a king and he's Jewish? I've said that in countries where it's not very safe to say that. But in Australia, who desperately wants to be a republic, I said, you never will be. You've got a king, and he's Jewish. He is already King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But one day the world will see that. And the story of Jerusalem will have come full circle. Because what is the very first thing we find in the Bible about Jerusalem? The Jebusites were ruled over by a king who was a priest called Melchizedek. And there's only ever been one other priest like him, combining king and priest, and that's Jesus. And so Jerusalem finishes up under a Melchizedek again. Full circle. God has brought it right back to where it began. Thank you. It's nice when somebody says hallelujah, but don't say it because the preacher wants you to say it. Amen? Shouldn't do it. Right, time has gone. If Jerusalem in the past belonged to the Jews for most of the time, if Jerusalem in the future is going to belong to a Jew, then I see no reason why they shouldn't have it now. I think they have the best claim, and they must be in Jerusalem for Jesus' return, because he told them he was coming back to them. And so I look forward to the day when Jerusalem is in the hands of the Son of David again. The God of Israel and the Father of Jesus gave the title deeds to the Jews forever. Amen.